Chapter 6. Covenant Vessel Vengeful Vitality, Orbiting Jonjer Com, 850 BCE, The Age of Reconciliation. A world spread out below McKen. Clouds spiraled around a giant crater, the immense blue sea known as the Great Apothea. The dark green of vegetation carpeted much of the main continent. Outer regions were more rugged. McKen recognized a number of features from his studies of the old holograms. Was that not Zelphys, where the fabled fortress of Granduin, undermined by the Stoics, had crumbled into the sea? And the crater? It was once the resting place of the Dreadnought, partly submerged below Apothea's surface, but it was now the mark of the great ship's ascension. It was the scar where the reformists had taken a god's fistful of the world as the mountain-high vessel rose to meet the stars. The planet below was Jonjer Com. Parts of Jonjer Com throbbed with life, with water, with greenery, with lights. Other parts seemed barrenly rocky. These regions, McKen supposed, might be the mark of the Forerunner's wrath. He'd found an ancient text referring to the punishment of his people's world long ago for their rebellion against the gods. But most now held that the tale was only a myth, used to inspire fear in the defiant and explain the vagaries of the planet. Or was it true? Had the Sacred Ones, the makers of the path to the Great Journey, been so furious with his people's sins that they burned vast populated areas of the planet away? How could one follow a path laid down by such divines? Could a flame of punishment be a manifestation of the holy light of the cosmos? Perhaps it could be. The fires of destruction were everywhere. Scourges wiped out entire species. Droughts came and went. Asteroids crashed murderously into inhabited planets. And suns were known to destroy themselves. Indeed, the very star at the center of this system, the sun that had warmed Jonjer Com for billions of solar cycles, was thought by some to be particularly unstable. Certain Sanshayum astronomers had muttered darkly that the end was coming one day. But the great journey promised transcendence, an escape from the inexorable arrow of time, from the endless erosion that is entropy. If the great journey was real. But of course it was. Either that, or the covenant, the path, McKen's entire life, was meaningless. Perhaps when he found the purifying vision of the holy path, if indeed the relic was where excellent redolence said it was, he might then see his way clearly. The relic would surely be a light of inspiration, so it was rumored to be. But the sight of Jonjer Com itself moved him deeply. As he gazed at it, he thought, "Here is the mother I have never known. This is my true lineage. This is the womb of my people. A million solar cycles and more of Sanshayum history took place here. This was where Sanshayum emerged from the seas, where they began to farm, to build, to create civilization, where they shed their blood as they struggled with one another for sovereignty." The soil of Jonjer Com was impregnated with the blood of McKen's ancestors. Over a millennia ago, McKen's reformist family had fled from this world, had vaulted on the Dreadnought into the stars. Gazing upon it now, for the first time in his life, McKen felt more moved than he had in many cycles. He felt an emotion welling from deep within, from the very cells, the genetic core of his being. Jonjer Com! He wanted to cry out, to weep with the glory and anguish of it. But the cry went unvoiced. He had to continue his pose of austerity. He had to be the prophet of inner conviction. "You seem to be meditating deeply, Eminence," someone said at his elbow. I fear to disturb you, but... Startled, McKen spun his chair about to find Vervum Lacoser, the ship's captain and coxswain, in an anti-grav chair, gazing at him with his large, mocking dark eyes. It struck McKen that this Vervum was not at all in awe of the prophet of inner conviction, and McKen instantly suspected that Vervum was Erno's man, was at least a spy for the Minister of Anticipatory Security. It was quite possible that Vervum was even an agent for that ministry. Surely Erno had been recruiting for his new intelligence fiefdom. Vervum's chair was decorated with the holograms of the Covenant's military arm, like fringes of colored light, and he wore a uniform robe sewn with stars indicating the systems he'd served in. "I see you served at the planet of red and blue, as I did," McKen remarked, as he tried to get his composure back. "You were on the dreadnought there." "I was on the planet, guarding the relic recovery team, O Prophet." "Ah, you and the others did a fine job." "The Sentinels did most of it. I regret that the seditious Usa Zalus escaped your net, O Prophet." Interesting how Vervum put that. "Your net," laying it all on McKen's shoulders. Yes, he was likely Erno's agent. McKen made a mental note to beware of treachery from the captain of this vessel. Could it be that Erno intended to let inner conviction do the work, take the risk here, and then eliminate him, have him assassinated on Jonjur Com, so that he was not present to take the credit for the mission's success? If so, Erno was assuming too much. McKen himself doubted the mission's chances of success. There were too many imponderables on the planet below, too many Stoics, too much toxic history between Stoics and Reformists. And if they were successful, Erno was assuming far too much about inner conviction, that he was foolish enough to allow himself to be stabbed in the back. "I will not make it easy for you, Erno." "Captain, have you been monitoring transmissions from Jonjur Com?" "Yes. Their language is archaic, but we manage to understand them. They do not seem to be aware of our orbital position. They have some satellites, some simple technology. But on the whole, they seem to be the Stoics they were when our people left. Predictably, they have resisted progress. They don't appear to have the capability of penetrating our stealth shield." "Then let us position the ship over our drop zone, and prepare the drop ship for landing." The Refuge, an uncharted shield world. 850 BCE, the Age of Reconciliation. Tursa was finishing his scan of the cryptic floating devices in sublevel 4, a series of hovering three-dimensional rectangular cuboid objects that occasionally changed shape, becoming tetrahedral, octagonal, pyramidal, then back to rectangular cuboids. He had realized early on that the objects changed shape when he scanned them, or even when approached closely. They seemed aware of him, and again he had the uncanny feeling they were scrutinizing him rather than vice versa. If he spoke, muttering over his task, the objects emitted sweet chiming sounds, as if responding to him in some crystalline language. He stepped back and looked around the enormous hall, a bit spooked by this place. He was occasionally unsettled by the shield world, especially when he was alone in the alien artificial vaults and corridors, the chambers and galleries. The forerunners who had built this world seemed everywhere and nowhere. Their work was here, their artifacts, their architecture, the personality of their culture. Most of it seemed enigmatic to Tursa, and to most of the others, just as it should. Was it even permissible to understand the gods? But sometimes Tursa felt that the Forerunners were somewhere near at hand, watching, perhaps just around a corner or hidden behind some panel. Absurd to think that, of course. They had all passed from this plane of existence. The Covenant said they had taken the great journey. Usa said no one knew where the Forerunners went, or if they would ever be back, least of all the Covenant. But their traces were sacred to the Sangheili all the same. He remembered what he'd heard from Enduring Bias about the Disassembler. What was Usa planning? Disassembling the shield world. It sounded like madness. Put it out of your mind. You cannot possibly understand what Usa intends. But still... Krallan and Drem hurried up then. Drem was a taller, spindlier Sangheili than most, wearing rusted armor and leather braces and boots from the almost extinct and quite vicious barbed Thremalion of Sanghelios. Wearing the spiky running lizard skin was an affectation, usually to give the impression of membership in a victory or death cult. More mandible flappers than fighters, that victory or death bunch, Tursa's uncle had said. All boast. Drem had the old runic tattoos of victory or death on his neck, too, Tursa saw. Right now, Drem looked more like death than like victory. He looked shaken, his eyes shadowy, almost hollow. "I cannot abide this room," Drem said in a creaky voice. "I feel a vibration within me here. Not natural. Not right." Krallan nodded. "True enough." Drem had become a companion of Krallan's lately. They were an unpleasant pair to most of the others. But Krallan was slippery and glib, and sometimes the adherents listened to him. "I sense strangeness in here, too," Tursa admitted. "But if it was dangerous, Suln would know. Enduring Bias would warn us. I'm sure there is no cause for concern." What could go wrong, Krallan wondered with acrid sarcasm, in a room created by the gods, a room deep beneath the shell of an alien world. Why, nothing could go wrong there, I'm certain. "I have been here for some time," Tursa said. "As you see, nothing has harmed me." "Perhaps it is simply waiting," Drem said. "Perhaps it was waiting for more of us, for its little trap to be sprung." Tursa stared at him. "Trap? Indeed. Who knows what these things are for?" "I have a theory," Krallan put in. "I wonder if these vibrating shapes could be for testing souls. You have seen how reactive they are. They could be probing us, the Forerunners, the gods, the messengers of the cosmos. Could be using them to decide which of us live or die, if we are worthy or unworthy. When they decide..." He clashed his mandibles in the Sangheili version of a resigned shrug. Drem stepped back from the hovering geometrical figures, and then took another step back. "Those things can see inside me? My soul?" Tursa waved a hand, dismissing the idea. "That's Krallan's theory. More likely they are part of the shield world's energy system, or used in communications." "You are correct. They are used in communication," said Enduring Bias, buzzing into the room. The abrupt entry of Enduring Bias made Drem hiss and snarl, startled. "The Dark Angel slips up behind us." What an interesting cultural tang there is in that appellation, Dark Angel. "I hardly know what to say," Enduring Bias remarked, turning to scan Drem in curiosity. "What is it doing to me?" he muttered, backing away. "I feel a tingle. An intrusion." "Drem, it is only scanning you," Krallan said. "It is the Eye of the Forerunners, a sacred relic." "Relic, I am," said the machine. "The relic of an earlier age. But I have never felt sacred." "You said I was correct about communications," Tursa asked. Like youth of any race, he enjoyed being told he was right. It happened so rarely. Yes, said Enduring Bias. These are communication dispensers. It was once called the Chamber of Sensitive Geometries. These shapes generate a quantum action at a distance field, enabling instantaneous communication through barriers within the shield world. Of course, one must know the key, the entry phrase. I have lost that, I'm afraid. But we hope to rediscover it. Some of my files are restorable. Trem stared at the shifting, hovering shapes. Communication. And it is everywhere. So in a way, it watches whatever we do. It is aware of you, wherever you are on the planet, would be a more precise way of putting it. I do not trust such a thing, Trem muttered. Usa has brought us here to live like that. It isn't right. He doesn't even know how to use these devices, Tirsa said. So this machine says. But Suon is Usa's female, and she controls the machine. She certainly does not, Enduring Bias said. I resent the implication. I have a much higher purpose. I am programmed and instructed to do my best to monitor and even to repair this shield world. We do need some engineers here. The Huragok would be most welcome. You don't have any Huragok with you, do you? Huragok? What are those? Krallon asked. You see their like in this reproduction, Enduring Bias said, projecting an image of a strange hovering creature composed of billowing spheres and tentacles. But it looked familiar. I have never seen one, said Tirsa. But in the wars, my uncle saw one when they raided a Sanshayum ship. He told me about them. They are with the Sanshayum now, fixing things. Are they? Enduring Bias asked, its single electric blue eye glowing with renewed interest. The Sanshayum. Suon told me of them. I believe them to be a race with certain ancient connections to my creators. The Huragok, now. They were taken from here, when the decision was made not to test this facility, but, sadly, no one consulted me. I need the Huragok. One could wish the Sanshayum were the new occupants of this world, if indeed they have the Huragok handy. What treachery is this? Drem sputtered. The Sanshayum are the enemy. And this construct wishes to work for them instead of the Sangheili. I was merely expressing what I think could be characterized as a wistful observation, Enduring Bias said. What does all that mean? Trem demanded. It means, said Krallon thoughtfully, looking at the machine. Enduring Bias does in fact wish the Sanshayum were here, and it works closely with Usa. No, he just wants their engineers, Tirsa said, worried that some kind of rebellion was breaking out, and that he might be caught up in it, or killed if he didn't take part. He. It's a he, Drem said. He sniffed. It's a thing. A mere construct. I have engaged a male tonality, Enduring Bias said. It seems to generate more respect among those of your culture, for reasons quite unknown to me. I hypothesize a classic patriarchal structure, with the expected attempts to suppress it. What I'm trying to say, Tirsa interrupted, is that Enduring Bias wants the Huragok here to repair things, to fix the machines. And to do some repair on myself, said Enduring Bias. Yes, at this remove. As long as you do not damage this facility in any significant way, I am actually indifferent to the occupants. The creators seem to have departed. I know not where. I have been out of the communication spiral, out of the discussion, out of the loop. So, indifferent to occupants, Krallon scratched a mandible. You would condone the Sanshayum being here? Absolutely. Though only if it meant access to the Huragok, Enduring Bias said, at last becoming aware of some need for politesse. I do not reject the Sangheili. Indeed, the one called Suon Zelas has repaired some of my mechanism, and we have established a new rapport. After all, I've always been subject to the wishes of my programmers, and to some extent, I have been reprogrammed. Suon has reprogrammed you, and you desire the Sanshayum were here if it meant the Huragok as well, Krallan murmured. I find that interesting. That is mixing what does not need mixing, Tursa said, and using an old Sangheili expression, he added, it is mixing blood and oil. I certainly hope so, Krallan said. I would never question Usa's decisions. I just take note of this and that and wonder. But I am loyal to Usa and Suon and to this... What was it Usa said this morning? This mission of the new Sangheilios. I shouldn't have left the old Sangheilios, Drem muttered. This place seems more a trap than a refuge. Then he looked darkly at Tursa. You will not speak of what you have heard here, childling, Drem said. Tursa ground his teeth. I am young, but no childling. Drem snorted. Really now? You still have egg yolk on your neck. Come, Drem, Krallan said. It is time for the evening meal. It is swill. No real meat to it, Drem grumbled, following Krallan out. Tursa looked at Enduring Bias. I hope you don't casually repeat what you have heard here. If you do, you could cause bloodshed. That would be unsanitary, Enduring Bias said. Most disagreeable. With that, it flitted away. Tursa wondered if he should be the one to report this discussion, and if Usa might misunderstand Tursa's part in what had been said. Because it seemed to Tursa that subversion had taken place here. So far, it was only words. But back on Sangheilios, Tursa had known words alone to cause more than one beheading.